If you think you are in a doldrum, in a pickle, and no good can come of this, think again. If you think the world is a bad place, filled with negative events, think again. If you think your life is falling apart and it looks as if you'll never get it back together again, think again. You can train yourself to do this. Look how well you've trained yourself not to do it.
Thank you. I've never had the process set out for me so clearly. I wish it were as easily done as said, but now at least I understand it clearly, I think.
Well, if you need a review, we have several lifetimes.
What is the true path to God? Is it through renunciation, as some yogis believe? And what of this thing called suffering? Is suffering and service the path to God, as many ascetics say? Do we earn our way to heaven by being good, as so many religions teach, or are we free to act as we wish, violate or ignore any rule, set aside any traditional teachings, dive into any self-indulgences, and thus find nirvana, as many New Agers say? Which is it, strict moral standards or do as you please? Which is it, traditional values, or make it up as you go along? Which is it, the Ten Commandments or the Seven Steps to Enlightenment?
You have a great need to have it be one way or the other, don't you? Could it not be all of these?
I don't know. I'm asking you.
I will answer you then, as you can best understand, though I tell you now that your answer is within. I say this to all people who hear my words and seek my truth. Every heart which earnestly asks, which is the path to God, is shown. Each is given a heartfelt truth. Come to me along the path of your heart, not through a journey of your mind. You will never find me in your mind. In order to truly know God, you have to be out of your mind. Your question begs an answer, and I will not step aside from the thrust of your inquiry. I will begin with a statement that will startle you and perhaps offend the sensitivities of many people. There are no such things as the Ten Commandments.
Oh, my God, there aren't?
Who would I command? Myself? And why would such commandments be required? Whatever I want is, n'est-ce pas? Why is it therefore necessary to command anyone? And if I did issue commandments, would they not be automatically kept? How could I wish something to be so badly, that I would command it, and then sit by and watch it not be so? What kind of a king would do that? What kind of a ruler? And yet I tell you this, I am neither a king nor a ruler. I am simply and awesomely the Creator. Yet the Creator does not rule, but merely creates and keeps on creating. I have created you, blessed you, in the image and likeness of me, and I have made certain promises and commitments to you. I have told you in plain language how it will be with you when you become as one with me. You are, as Moses was, an earnest seeker. Moses too, as do you now, stood before me begging for answers. Oh, God of my fathers, he called, God of my God, deign to show me, give me a sign that I may tell my people. How can we know that we are chosen? And I came to Moses, even as I have come to you now, with a divine covenant, an everlasting promise, a sure and certain commitment. How can I be sure? Moses asked plaintively. Because I have told you so, I said, you have the word of God. And the word of God was not a commandment, but a covenant. These then are the Ten Commitments. You shall know that you have taken the path to God, and you shall know that you have found God, for there will be these signs, these indications, these changes in you. You shall love God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, And there shall be no other God set before me. No longer will you worship human love or success, money or power, nor any symbol thereof. You will set aside these things as a child sets aside toys. Not because they are unworthy, but because you have outgrown them. And you shall know that you have taken the path to God because you shall not use the name of God in vain. Nor will you call upon me for frivolous things. You will understand the power of words and of thoughts, and you would not think of invoking the name of God in an ungodly manner. You shall not use my name in vain, because you cannot. For my name, the great I Am, is never used in vain, that is, without result, nor can it ever be. And when you have found God, you shall know this. And I shall give you these other signs as well. You shall remember to keep a day for me, and you shall call it holy. This so that you do not long stay in your illusion, but cause yourself to remember who and what you are. And then shall you soon call every day the Sabbath, and every moment holy. You shall honor your mother and your father, and you will know you are the Son of God when you honor your father, mother, God, in all that you say or do or think. And even as you so honor the mother, father, God, and your father and mother on earth, for they have given you life, so too will you honor everyone. You know you have found God when you observe that you will not murder, that is, willfully kill without cause. For while you will understand that you cannot end another's life in any event, all life is eternal, you will not choose to terminate any particular incarnation nor change any life energy from one form to another without the most sacred justification. Your new reverence for life will cause you to honor all life forms, including plants, trees, and animals, and to impact them only when it is for the highest good. And these other signs will I send you also, that you may know you are on the path. You will not defile the purity of love with dishonesty or deceit, for this is adulterous. I promise you, when you have found God, you shall not commit this adultery. You will not take a thing that is not your own, nor cheat, nor connive, nor harm another to have anything, for this would be to steal. I promise you, when you have found God, you shall not steal. Nor shall you say a thing that is not true, and thus bear false witness. Nor shall you covet your neighbor's spouse, for why would you want your neighbor's spouse when you know all others are your spouse? Covet your neighbor's goods, for why would you want your neighbor's goods when you know that all goods can be yours, and all your goods belong to the world? You will know that you have found the path to God when you see these signs. For I promise that no one who truly seeks God shall any longer do these things. It would be impossible to continue such behaviors. These are your freedoms, not your restrictions. These are my commitments, not my commandments. For God does not order about what God has created. God merely tells God's children, "This is how you will know that you are coming home." Moses asked in earnest, "How may I know? Give me a sign." Moses asked the same question that you ask now, the same question all people everywhere have asked since time began. My answer is likewise eternal. But it has never been and never will be a commandment. For who shall I command? And who shall I punish should my commandment not be kept? There is only me.
So I don't have to keep the Ten Commandments in order to get to heaven.
There is no such thing as getting to heaven. There is only a knowing that you are already there. There is an accepting, an understanding, not a working for or a striving. You cannot go to where you already are. To do that, you would have to leave where you are, and that would defeat the whole purpose of the journey. The irony is that most people think they have to leave where they are to get where they want to be, and so they leave heaven in order to get to heaven and go through hell. Enlightenment is understanding that there is nowhere to go, nothing to do, and nobody you have to be except exactly who you're being right now. You are on a journey to nowhere. Heaven, as you call it, is nowhere. Let's just put some space between the W and the H in that word, and you'll see that heaven is now, here.
Everyone says that. It's driving me crazy. If heaven is now here, how come I don't see that? Why don't I feel that? And why is the world in such a mess?
I understand your frustration. It's almost as frustrating trying to understand all this as it is trying to get someone to understand it.
Whoa, wait a minute. Are you trying to say to me that God gets frustrated?
Who do you suppose invented frustration? And do you imagine that you can experience something I cannot? I tell you this. Every experience you have, I have. Do you not see I am experiencing myself through you? What else do you suppose all this is for? I could not know myself were it not for you. I created you that I might know who I am. Now, I would not shatter all of your illusions about me in one moment, so I will tell you that in my most sublime form, which you call God, I do not experience frustration.
Well, that's better. You scared me there for a minute.
But that's not because I can't. It's simply because I don't choose to. You can make the same choice, by the way.
Well, frustrated or not, I still wonder how it can be that heaven is right here and I don't experience it.
You cannot experience what you don't know. And you don't know you are in heaven right now because you have not experienced it. You see, for you, it's a vicious circle. You cannot, have not found a way yet to experience what you do not know. And you do not know what you have not experienced. What enlightenment asks you to do is to know something you have not experienced and thus experience it. Knowing opens the door to experience, and you imagine it's the other way around. Actually, you know a great deal more than you have experience. You simply don't know that you know. You know that there is a God, for instance, but you may not know that you know that. So you keep waiting around for the experience, and all the while, you keep having it. Yet you are having it without knowing, which is like not having it at all.
Boy, we're going around in circles here.
Yes, we are. And instead of going around in circles, perhaps we should be the circle itself. This doesn't have to be a vicious circle. It can be a sublime one.
Okay, a question then. Is renunciation a part of the truly spiritual life?
Yes, because ultimately all spirit renounces what is not real. And nothing in the life you lead is real, save your relationship with me. Yet renunciation, in the classic sense of self-denial, is not required. A true master does not give up something. A true master simply sets it aside, as he would do with anything for which he no longer has any use. There are those who say you must overcome your desires. I say you must simply change them. The first practice feels like a rigorous discipline. The second, a joyful exercise. There are those who say that to know God you must overcome all earthly passions, yet to understand and accept them is enough. What you resist persists. What you look at disappears. Those who seek so earnestly to overcome all earthly passions often work at it so hard that it might be said this has become their passion. They have a passion for God. A passion to know him. But passion is passion, and to trade one for the other does not eliminate it. Therefore, judge not that about which you feel passionate. Simply notice it, then see if it serves you, given who and what you wish to be. Remember, you are constantly in the act of creating yourself. You are in every moment deciding who and what you are. You decide this largely through the choices you make
regarding who and what you feel passionate about. Often a person on what you call a spiritual path looks like he has renounced all earthly passion, all human desire. What he has done is understand it, see the illusion, and step aside from the passions that do not serve him, all the while loving the illusion for what it has brought to him, the chance to be wholly free. Passion is the love of turning being into action. It fuels the engine of creation. It changes concepts to experience. Passion is the fire that drives us to express who we really are. Never deny passion, for that is to deny who you are and who you truly want to be. The renunciate never denies passion. The renunciate simply denies attachment to results. Passion is a love of doing. Doing is being experienced. Yet what is often created as part of doing? Expectation. To live your life without expectation, without the need for specific results, that is freedom. That is godliness. That is how I live.
You are not attached to results?
Absolutely not. My joy is in the creating, not in the aftermath. Renunciation is not a decision to deny action. Renunciation is a decision to deny a need for a particular result. There's a vast difference.
Could you explain what you mean by the statement, passion is the love of turning being into action?
Beingness is the highest state of existence. It is the purest essence. It is the now, not now, the all, not all, the always, never aspect of God. Pure being is pure God-ing. Yet it has never been enough for us to simply be. We have always yearned to experience what we are, and that requires a whole other aspect of divinity called doing. Let us say that you are at the core of your wonderful self, that aspect of divinity called love. This is, by the way, the truth of you. Now, it is one thing to be love, and quite another thing to do something loving. The soul longs to do something about what it is in order that it might know itself in its own experience. So it will seek to realize its highest idea through action. This urge to do this is called passion. Kill passion and you kill God. Passion is God wanting to say, hi. But you see, once God, or God in you, does that loving thing, God has realized itself and needs nothing more. Man, on the other hand, often feels he needs a return on his investment. If we're going to love somebody, fine, but we better get some love back. That sort of thing. This is not passion. This is expectation. This is the greatest source of man's unhappiness. It is what separates man from God. The renunciate seeks to end this separation through the experience some Eastern mystics have called samadhi. That is oneness and union with God, a melding with and melting into divinity. The renunciate therefore renounces results, but never ever renounces passion. Indeed, the master knows intuitively that passion is the path. It is the way to self-realization. Even in earthly terms, it can be fairly said that if you have a passion for nothing, you have no life at all.
You've said that what you resist persists and what you look at disappears. Can you explain that?
You cannot resist something to which you grant no reality. The act of resisting a thing is the act of granting it life. When you resist an energy, you place it there. The more you resist, the more you make it real, whatever it is you are resisting. What you open your eyes to look at disappears. That is, it ceases to hold its illusory form. If you look at something, truly look at it, you will see right through it and right through any illusion it holds for you, leaving nothing but ultimate reality in your sight. In the face of ultimate reality, your puny illusion has no power. It cannot long hold you in its weakening grip. You see the truth of it, and the truth sets you free.
But what if you don't want the thing you're looking at to disappear?
You should always want it to. There's nothing in your reality to hold on to. And if you do choose the illusion of your life over ultimate reality, you may simply recreate it, just as you created it to begin with. In this way, you may have in your life what you choose to have, and eliminate from your life what you no longer wish to experience. You never resist anything. If you think that by your resistance you will eliminate it, think again. You only plant it more firmly in place. Have I not told you all thought is creative?
Even a thought that says I don't want something?
If you don't want it, why think about it? Don't give it a second thought. Yet if you must think about it, that is, if you cannot not think about it, then do not resist. Rather, look at whatever it is directly. Accept the reality as your creation. Then choose to keep it or not, as you wish.
Who would dictate that choice?
Who and what you think you are dictate that choice. And who and what you choose to be. This dictates all choice. Every choice you have made in your life and ever will make.
And so the life of a renunciate is an incorrect path.
That is not a truth. The word renunciate holds such wrongful meaning. In truth, you cannot renounce anything. Because what you resist persists. The true renunciate does not renounce, but simply chooses differently. This is an act of moving towards something, not away from something. You cannot move away from something because it will chase you all over hell and back. Therefore, resist not temptation, but simply turn from it. Turn toward me and away from anything unlike me. You know this. There is no such thing as an incorrect path. For on this journey, you cannot not get where you are going. It is simply a matter of speed, merely a question of when you will get there. Yet even that is an illusion, for there is no when, neither is there a before or after. There's only now, an eternal moment of always in which you are experiencing yourself.
Then what's the point? If there's no way not to get there, what's the point of life? Why should we worry at all about anything we do?
Well, of course you shouldn't. But you would do well to be observant. Simply notice who and what you are being, doing, and having, and see whether it serves you. The point of life is not to get anywhere. It is to notice that you are, and have always been, already there. You are, always and forever, in the moment of pure creation. The point of life is therefore to create who and what you are, and then to experience that.
And what of suffering? Is suffering the way and the path to God? Some say it is the only way.
I am not pleased by suffering, and whoever says I am does not know me. Suffering is an unnecessary aspect of the human experience. It is not only unnecessary, it is unwise, uncomfortable, and hazardous to your health.
Then why is there so much suffering? Why don't you, if you are God, put an end to it, if you dislike it so much?
I have put an end to suffering. You simply refuse to use the tools I have given you with which to realize that. You see, suffering has nothing to do with events, but with one's reaction to them. What's happening is merely what's happening. How you feel about it is another matter. I've given you the tools with which to respond and react to events in a way which reduces, in fact, eliminates pain. But you've not used them.
Excuse me, but why not eliminate the events?
A very good suggestion. Unfortunately, I have no control over them.
You have no control over events?
Of course not. Events are occurrences in time and space which you produce out of choice. And I will never interfere with choices. To do so would be to obviate the very reason I created you. But I've explained all this before. Some events you produce willfully. Some events you draw to you, more or less unconsciously. Some events, major natural disasters are among those you toss into this category, are written off to fate. And even FATE can be an acronym for From All Thoughts Everywhere. In other words, the consciousness of the planet.
The collective consciousness.
Precisely, exactly.
There are those who say the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Our ecology is dying, our planet is in for major geophysical disasters, earthquakes, volcanoes, maybe even a tilting of the Earth on its axis. There are others who say collective consciousness can change all that, that we can save the Earth with our thoughts.
Thoughts put into action. If enough people everywhere believe something must be done to help the environment, you will save the Earth. But you must work fast. So much damage has already been done for so long. This will take a major attitudinal shift.
You mean if we don't, we'll see the Earth and its inhabitants destroyed?
I have made the laws of the physical universe clear enough for anyone to understand. There are laws of cause and effect which have been sufficiently outlined to your scientists, physicists, and through them to your world leaders. These laws don't need to be outlined once more here.
Well, getting back to suffering, then, where did we ever get the idea that suffering was good, that the saintly suffer in silence?
The saintly do suffer in silence, but that does not mean suffering is good. The students in the School of Mastery suffer in silence because they understand that suffering is not the way of God, but rather a sure sign that there is still something to learn of the way of God, still something to remember. The true master does not suffer in silence at all, but only appears to be suffering without complaint. The reason that the true master does not complain is that the true master is not suffering, but simply experiencing a set of circumstances that you would call insufferable. A practicing master does not speak of suffering simply because a master practicing clearly understands the power of the word, and so chooses to simply not say a word about it. We make real that to which we pay attention. The master knows this. The master places himself at choice with regard to that which she chooses to make real. You've all done this from time to time. There's not a one among you who has not made a headache disappear, or a visit to the dentist less painful through your decision about it. The master simply makes the same decision about larger things.
But why have suffering at all? Why have even the possibility of suffering?
You cannot know and become that which you are in the absence of that which you are not, as I have already explained to you.
I still don't understand how he ever got the idea that suffering was good.
You are wise to be insistent in questioning that. The original wisdom surrounding suffering and silence has become so perverted that now many believe, and several religions actually teach, that suffering is good and joy is bad. Therefore, you have decided that if someone has cancer but keeps it to himself, he is a saint. Whereas if someone has, to pick a dynamite topic, robust sexuality and celebrates it openly, she is a sinner.
Boy, you did pick a dynamite topic. And you cleverly changed the pronoun, too, from male to female. Was that to make a point?
It was to show you your prejudices. You don't like to think of women having robust sexuality, much less celebrating it openly. You would rather see a man dying without a whimper on the battlefield than a woman making love with a whimper in the street.
Wouldn't you?
I have no judgment one way or the other, but you have all sorts of them. And I suggest that it is your judgments which keep you from joy and your expectations which make you unhappy. All of this put together is what causes you dis-ease. And therein begins your suffering.
How do I know that what you're saying is true? How do I know this is even God speaking and not my own overactive imagination?
You've asked that before. My answer is the same. What difference does it make? Even if everything I've said is wrong, can you think of a better way to live?
No.
Then wrong is right. And right is wrong. And I'll tell you this, to help you out of your dilemma, believe nothing I say. Simply live it. Experience it. Then live whatever other paradigm you want to construct. Afterward, look to your experience to find your truth. One day, if you have a great deal of courage, you will experience a world where making love is considered better than making war. On that day, will you rejoice?
Life is so scary and so confusing. I wish things could be more clear.
There's nothing scary about life if you are not attached to results.
You mean if you don't want anything?
That's right. Choose, but don't want.
That's easy for people who don't have anyone depending on them. What if you have a wife and children?
The path of the householder has always been a most challenging path. Perhaps the most challenging. As you point out, it is easy to want nothing when you're only dealing with yourself. It is natural when you have others you love to want only the best for them.
Well, it hurts when you can't give them all that you want them to have. A nice home, some decent clothes, enough food. I feel as though I've been struggling for 20 years just to make ends meet, when I still have nothing to show for it.
You mean in terms of material wealth?
I mean in terms of just some of the basics that a man would like to pass on to his children. I mean in terms of some of the very simple things a man would like to provide for his wife.
I see. You see, it is your job in life to provide all these things. Is that what you imagine your life to be about?
I'm not sure I'd state it that way. This is not what my life is about. But it sure would be nice if this could be a byproduct, at least.
Well, let's go back then. What do you see your life being about?
That's a good question. I've had a lot of different answers to that through the years.
What is your answer now?
Well, it feels as though I have two answers to that question. The answer I'd like to see and the answer I'm seeing.
What's the answer you'd like to see?
I'd like to see my life being about the evolution of my soul. I'd like to see my life being about expressing and experiencing the part of me I love most, the part of me that is compassion and patience and giving and helping, the part of me that is knowing and wise, forgiving and love.
Sounds like you've been listening to me.
Yes. Yes, it's beautiful on an esoteric level, but I'm trying to figure out how to practicalize that. So the answer to your question that I see being real in my life is that it's about day-to-day survival.
Oh, and you think one precludes the other?
Well,
you think esoterics preclude survival?
The truth is, I'd like to do more than just survive. I've been surviving all these years. I notice I'm still here. But I'd like the struggle for survival to end. I see that just getting by from day to day is still a struggle. I'd like to do more than just survive. I'd like to prosper.
Now, what would you call prospering?
Having enough that I don't have to worry where my next dollar is coming from. Not having to stress and strain just to make the rent or handle the phone bill. I mean, I hate to get so mundane, but we're talking real life here, not an airy-fairy, spiritually romanticized picture of life.
Do I hear a little anger there?
Not anger so much as frustration. I've been at the spiritual game for over 20 years now, and look where it's gotten me. One paycheck away from the poorhouse. And now I've just lost my job, and it looks like the cash flow has stopped again. I'm getting really tired of the struggle. I'm 49 years old, and I'd like to have some security in life so I could devote more time to God stuff, to soul evoluting. That is where my heart is, but it's not where my life allows me to go.
Well, you've said a mouthful there, and I suspect you're speaking for a whole lot of people when you share that experience. I'm going to respond to your truth one sentence at a time so that we can easily track and dissect the answer. You've not been at this spiritual game for 20 years. You've been barely skirting the edges of it. This is not a spanking, by the way. This is just a statement of the truth. I'll concede that for 2 decades you've been looking at it, flirting with it, experimenting now and then, but I haven't felt your truest commitment to the game until just recently. Let's be clear that being at the spiritual game means dedicating your whole mind, your whole body, your whole soul to the process of creating self in the image and likeness of God. This is the process of self-realization about which Eastern mystics have written. This is the process of salvation to which much Western theology has devoted itself. This is a day-to-day, hour-to-hour, moment-to-moment act of supreme consciousness. It is a choosing and a re-choosing every instant. It is ongoing creation, conscious creation, creation with a purpose. It is using the tools of creation we have discussed and using them with awareness and sublime intention. That is playing this spiritual game. Now, how long have you been at this?
I haven't even begun.
Don't go from one extreme to the other, and don't be so hard on yourself. You have been dedicated to this process, and you're actually engaged in it. More than you'll give yourself credit for. But you haven't been doing so for 20 years, or anything close to that. Yet the truth is, how long you have been engaged in it is not important. Are you engaged in it now? That's all that matters. Let's move on with your
statement. You ask us to look where it's gotten you, and you describe yourself as being one step away from the poorhouse. I look at you and see quite a different thing. I see a person who's one step away from the rich house. You feel you are one paycheck from oblivion, and I see you as one paycheck from nirvana. Now, much depends, of course, on what you see as your pay and to what end you are working. If the object of your life is to acquire what you call security, I see and understand why you feel you are one paycheck away from the poorhouse. Yet even this assessment is open to correction, because with my pay, all good things come to you, including the experience of feeling secure in the physical world. My pay, the payoff you get when you work for me, provides a great deal more than spiritual comfort. Physical comfort, too, can be yours. Yet the ironic part about all this is that once you experience the kind of spiritual comfort my payoff provides, the last thing you'll find yourself worrying about is physical comfort. Even the physical comfort of members of your family will no longer be a concern to you. For once you rise to a level of God consciousness, you will understand that you are not responsible for any other human soul, and that while it is commendable to wish every soul to live in comfort, each soul must choose, is choosing, its own destiny this instant. Clearly, it is not the highest action to deliberately abuse or destroy another. Clearly, it is equally inappropriate to neglect the needs of those you have caused to be dependent on you. Your job is to render them independent, to teach them as quickly and completely as possible how to get along without you. For you are no blessing to them as long as they need you to survive. But bless them truly only in the moment they realize you are unnecessary. In the same sense, God's greatest moment is the moment you realize you need no God. I know, this is the antithesis of everything you've ever been taught. Your teachers have told you of an angry God, a jealous God, a God who needs to be needed. And that is not a God at all, but a neurotic substitute for that which would be a deity. A true master is not the one with the most students, but one who creates the most masters. A true leader is not the one with the most followers, but one who creates the most leaders. A true king is not the one with the most subjects, but one who leads the most to royalty. A true teacher is not the one with the most knowledge, but one who causes the most others to have knowledge. And a true God is not one with the most servants, but one who serves the most, thereby making gods of all others. For this is both the goal and the glory of God, that my subjects shall be no more, and that all shall know God not as the unattainable, but as the unavoidable. I would that you could this understand. Your happy destiny is unavoidable. You cannot not be saved. There is no hell except not knowing this. So now, as parents, spouses, and loved ones, seek not to make of your love a glue that binds, but rather a magnet that first attracts, then turns around and repels, lest those who are attracted begin to believe they must stick to you to survive. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be more damaging to another. Let your love propel your beloveds into the world and into the full experience of who they are. In this will you have truly loved. It is a great challenge, this path of the householder. There are many distractions, many worldly concerns. The ascetic is bothered by none of these. He has brought his bread and water and given his humble mat on which to lie. And he can devote his every hour to prayer, meditation, and contemplation of the divine. How easy to see the divine under such circumstances. How simple a task. Ah, but give one a spouse and children. See the divine in a baby who needs changing at 3 a.m. See the divine in a bill that needs paying by the first of the month. Recognize the hand of God in the illness that takes a spouse, the job that's lost, the child's fever, the parent's pain. Now we are talking saintliness. I understand your fatigue. I know you are tired of the struggle. Yet I tell you this. When you follow me, the struggle disappears. Live in your God space, and the events become blessings, one and all.
How can I get to my God space? When I've lost my job, the rent needs paying, the kids need a dentist, and being in my lofty philosophical space seems the least likely way to solve any of this.
Do not forsake me when you need me most. Now is the hour of your greatest testing. Now is the time of your greatest chance. It is the chance to prove everything that has been recorded here. When I say don't forsake me, I sound like that needy neurotic God we talked about, but I'm not. You can forsake me all you want. I don't care. And it won't change a thing between us. I merely say this in answer to your questions. It is when the going gets tough that you so often forget who you are and the tools I have given you for creating the life that you would choose. Now is the time to go to your God space more than ever. First, it will bring you great peace of mind, and from a peaceful mind do great ideas flow. Ideas which could be solutions to the biggest problems you imagine yourself to have. Second, it is in your God space that you self-realize. And that is the purpose, the only purpose of your soul. When you are in your God space, you know and understand that all you are now experiencing is temporary. I tell you that heaven and earth shall pass away, but you shall not. This everlasting perspective helps you to see things in their proper light. You can define these present conditions and circumstances as what they truly are, temporary and temporal. You may then use them as tools, for that is what they are, temporary, temporal tools in the creation of present experience. Just who do you think you are in relationship to the experience called lose a job? Who do you think you are? And perhaps more to the point, who do you think I am? Do you imagine this is too big a problem for me to solve? Is getting out of this jam too big a miracle for me to handle? I understand that you may think it's too big for you to handle, even with all the tools I've given you, but do you really think it's too big for me?
Well, I know intellectually that no job is too big for God, but emotionally, I guess I can't be sure. Not whether you can handle it, but whether you will.
I see. So it's a matter of faith.
Well, yes.
You don't question my ability, you merely doubt my desire.
You see, I still live this theology that says there may be a lesson in here somewhere for me. I'm still not sure I'm supposed to have a solution. Maybe I'm supposed to have the problem. Maybe this is one of those tests my theology keeps telling me about. So I worry that this problem may not be solved, that this is one of those you're going to let me hang here with.
Perhaps this is a good time to go over once more how it is that I interact with you. because you think it is a question of my desire, and I'm telling you it's a question of yours. I want for you what you want for you. Nothing more, nothing less. I don't sit here and make a judgment, request by request, whether something should be granted you. My law is the law of cause and effect, not the law of we'll see. There is nothing you can't have, if you choose it. Even before you ask, I will have given it to you. Do you believe this?
Nope. I'm sorry, I've seen too many prayers go unanswered.
Don't be sorry, just always stay with the truth. The truth of your experience. I understand that. I honor that. That's okay with me.
Good, because I don't believe that whatever I ask, I get. My life has not been a testimony to that. In fact, I rarely get what I ask for. When I do, I consider myself damn lucky.
That's an interesting choice of words. You have an option, it seems. In your life, you can either be damned lucky, or you can be blessing lucky. I'd rather you be blessing lucky, but of course, I'll never interfere with your decisions. I tell you this, you always get what you create, and you are always creating. I don't make a judgment about the creations that you conjure. I simply empower you to conjure more and more and more and more. If you don't like what you've just created, choose again. My job as God is to always give you that opportunity. Now you're telling me that you haven't always gotten what you wanted. Yet I'm here to tell you that you've always gotten what you called forth. Your life is always a result of your thoughts about it, including your obviously creative thought that you seldom get what you choose. Now, in this present instance, you see yourself as the victim of the situation in the losing of your job. Yet the truth is that you no longer chose that job. You stopped getting up in the morning in anticipation and began getting up with dread. You stopped feeling happy about your work and began feeling resentment. You even began fantasizing doing something else. You think these things mean nothing? You misunderstand your power. I tell you this, your life proceeds out of your intentions for it. So what is your intention now? Do you intend to prove your theory that life seldom brings you what you choose? Or do you intend to demonstrate who you really are and who I am?
Well, I feel chagrined, chastised, embarrassed.
Does that serve you? Why not simply acknowledge the truth when you hear it and move toward it? There's no need to recriminate against yourself. Simply notice what you've been choosing and choose again.
But why am I so ready to always choose the negative and then spank myself for it?
What can you expect? You were told from your earliest days that you're bad. You accept that you were born in sin. Feeling guilty is a learned response. You've been told to feel guilty about yourself for things you did before you could even do anything. You've been taught to feel shame for being born less than perfect. This alleged state of imperfection in which you are said to have come into this world is what your religionists have the gall to call original sin. And it is original sin, but not yours. It is the first sin to be perpetrated upon you by a world which knows nothing of God if it thinks that God would or could create anything imperfect. Some of your religions have built up whole theologies around this misconception. And that is what it is, literally, a misconception. For anything I conceive, all that to which I give life is perfect, a perfect reflection of perfection itself, made in the image and likeness of me. Yet in order to justify the idea of a punitive God, your religions needed to create something for me to be angry about. So even those people who lead exemplary lives somehow need to be saved. If they don't need to be saved from themselves, then they need to be saved from their own built-in imperfection. So, these religions say, you'd better do something about all of this, and fast, or you'll go straight to hell. This, in the end, may do nothing to mollify a weird, vindictive, angry God, but it does give life to weird, vindictive, angry religions. Thus do religions perpetuate themselves. Thus does power remain concentrated in the hands of the few, rather than experience through the hands of the many. Of course you choose constantly the lesser thought, the smaller idea, the tiniest conception of yourself and your power, to say nothing of me and mine. You've been taught to.
My God, how can I undo the teaching?
You can undo the teaching by listening to our conversations over and over again. Until you understand every passage, until you're familiar with every word, when you can repeat its passages to others, when you can bring its phrases to mind in the midst of the darkest hour, then you will have undone the teaching.
Yet there is still so much I want to ask you, still so much I want to know.
Indeed. You had a lot of questions. Shall we get back to them?
When will I learn enough about relationships to be able to have them go smoothly? Is there a way to be happy in relationships? Must they be constantly challenging?
You have nothing to learn about relationships. You have only to demonstrate what you already know. There is a way to be happy in relationships, and that is to use relationships for their intended purpose, not the purpose you have designed. Relationships are constantly challenging, constantly calling you to create, express, and experience higher and higher aspects of yourself, grander and grander visions of yourself, ever more magnificent versions of yourself. Nowhere can you do this more immediately, impactfully, and immaculately than in relationships. In fact, without relationships, you cannot do it at all. It is only through your relationship with other people, places, and events that you can even exist as a knowable quantity, as an identifiable something in the universe. Remember, absent everything else, you are not. You only are what you are relative to another thing that is not. That is how it is in the world of the relative, as opposed to the world of the absolute, where I reside. Once you clearly understand this, once you deeply grasp it, then you intuitively bless each and every experience, all human encounter, and especially personal human relationships, for you see them as constructive in the highest sense. You see that they can be used, must be used, are being used, whether you want them to be or not, to construct who you really are. That construction can be a magnificent creation of your own conscious design or a strictly happenstance configuration. You can choose to be a person who has resulted simply from what has happened or from what you've chosen to be and do about what has happened. It is in the latter form that creation of self becomes conscious. It is in the second experience that self becomes realized. Bless, therefore, every relationship and hold each as special and formative of who you are and now choose to be. Now, your inquiry has to do with individual human relationships of the romantic sort, and I understand that. So let me address myself specifically and at length to human love relationships, these things which continue to give you such trouble. When human love relationships fail, relationships never truly fail except in the strictly human sense that they did not produce what you want. They fail because they were entered into for the wrong reason. Wrong, of course, is a relative term, meaning something measured against that which is right, whatever that is. It'd be more accurate in your own language to say relationships fail, change, most often when they are entered into for reasons not wholly beneficial or conducive to their survival. Most people enter into relationships with an eye toward what they can get out of them rather than what they can put into them. The purpose of a relationship is to decide what part of yourself you'd like to see show up, not what part of another you can capture and hold. There can be only one purpose for relationships and for all of life, to be and to decide who you really are. It is very romantic to say that you were nothing until that special other came along. But it's not true. Worse, it puts an incredible pressure on the other to be all sorts of things he or she is not. Not wanting to let you down, they try very hard to be and do these things until they cannot anymore. They can no longer complete your picture of them. They can no longer fill the roles to which they have been assigned. Resentment builds, anger follows. Finally, in order to save themselves and the relationship, these special others begin to reclaim their real selves, acting more in accordance with who they really are. It is about this time that you say they've really changed. It's very romantic to say that now that your special other has entered your life, you feel complete. Yet the purpose of relationship is not to have another who might complete you, but to have another with whom you might share your completeness. Here is the paradox of all human relationships. You have no need for a particular other in order for you to experience fully who you are. And without another, you're nothing. This is both the mystery and the wonder, the frustration and the joy of the human experience. It requires deep understanding and total willingness to live within this paradox in a way which makes sense. I observe that very few people do. Most of you enter your relationship-forming years ripe with anticipation, full of sexual energy, a wide-open heart, and a joyful, if eager, soul. Somewhere between 40 and 60, and for most it is sooner rather than later, you've given up on your grandest dream, set aside your highest hope, and settled for your lowest expectation, or nothing at all. The problem is so basic, so simple, and yet so tragically misunderstood. Your grandest dream, your highest idea, and your fondest hope has had to do with your beloved other rather than your beloved self. The test of your relationships has had to do with how well the other lived up to your ideas and how well you saw yourself living up to his or hers. Yet the only true test has to do with how well you live up to yours. Relationships are sacred because they provide life's grandest opportunity. Indeed, its only opportunity to create and produce the experience of your highest conceptualization of self. Relationships fail when you see them as life's grandest opportunity to create and produce the experience of your highest conceptualization of another. Let each person in relationship worry about self. What self is being, doing, and having? What self is wanting, asking, giving? What self is seeking, creating, experiencing? And all relationships would magnificently serve their purpose and their participants. Let each person in relationship worry not about the other, but only about self. This seems a strange teaching, for you've been told that in the highest form of relationship, one worries only about the other. Yet I tell you this, your focus upon the other, your obsession with the other, is what causes relationships to fail. What is the other being? What is the other doing? What is the other having? What is the other saying, wanting, demanding? What is the other thinking, expecting, planning? The master understands that it doesn't matter what the other is being, doing, having, saying, wanting, demanding. It doesn't matter what the other is thinking, expecting, planning. It only matters what you are being in relationship to that. The most loving person is the person who is self. Centered.
Whew, that is a radical teaching.
Not if you look at it carefully. If you cannot love yourself, you cannot love another. Many people make the mistake of seeking love of self through love of another. Of course, they don't realize they are doing this. It's not a conscious effort. It's what's going on in the mind, deep in the mind, in what you call the subconscious. They think, if I can just love others, they will love me. Then I will be lovable, and I can love me. The reverse of this is that so many people hate themselves because they feel there is not another who loves them. This is a sickness. It's when people are truly lovesick, because the truth is, other people do love them, but it doesn't matter. No matter how many people profess their love for them, it's not enough. First, they don't believe you. They think you are trying to manipulate them, trying to get something. How could you love them for who they truly are? No, there must be some mistake. You must want something. Now, what do you want? They sit around trying to figure out how anyone could actually love them, so they don't believe you and embark on a campaign to make you prove it. You have to prove that you love them. To do this, they may ask you to start altering your behavior. Second, if they finally come to a place where they can believe you love them, they begin at once to worry about how long they can keep your love. So in order to hold on to your love, they start altering their behavior. Thus, two people literally lose themselves in a relationship. They get into the relationship hoping to find themselves, and they lose themselves instead. This losing of the self in a relationship is what causes most of the bitterness in such couplings. Two people join together in a partnership, hoping that the whole will be greater than the sum of the parts, only to find that it's less. They feel less than when they were single, less capable, less able, less exciting, less attractive, less joyful, less content. This is because they are less. They've given up most of who they are in order to be and to stay in their relationship. Relationships were never meant to be this way. Yet this is how they are experienced by more people than you could ever know.
Why? Why?
It's because people have lost touch with, if they ever were in touch with, the purpose of relationships. When you lose sight of each other as sacred souls on a sacred journey, then you cannot see the purpose, the reason behind all relationships. The soul has come to the body, and the body to life, for the purpose of evolution. You are evolving, you are becoming, and you are using your relationship with everything to decide what you are becoming.